Welcome all. My name is Stephen Prower. I'm the director of the Melbourne Materials Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the University of Melbourne and to this public lecture, From Toilet to Tap, obviously about water recycling. We are very privileged today to be to have three speakers who I'll introduce in just a moment. But I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, their elders past and present. When I started studying materials, I was aware of the fact that every age of history has been driven by materials. We started off with the Stone Age, and then we had the Bronze Age, and now some people say that last century was the Silicon Age, and now some people say that today we live in the Garb Age. And it is certainly true that we lack for resources, but we also do not in any way recycle even a small percentage of what we consume. And one of our most precious resources is water, and the recycling of water is the topic today. I'm sure you'll hear the speakers tell us that overseas, most water in a city is recycled and we just send it out to the sea. So, but it's not my job to tell you about water recycling. I will say that the Materials Institute is very pleased to be sponsoring this event, because our job as the Materials Institute of the University of Melbourne is to show and share with the public the technologies, the materials technologies and developments that are available today to solve big problems, of which surely water recycling is one. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our first Adam Band to kick off proceedings. Adam is, I think, the only Greens member of the House of Representatives, and he represents the electorate of Melbourne, and he was elected to the House in 2010. He has a dizzying array of responsibilities within the Greens, within the Green Party, of which being science and research spokesman is the most relevant for this evening. But I'll notice that he also assists in climate and energy, innovation and industry, high-speed rail, emergency services, banking, employment and workforce relations. He must do a lot of reading in the evening. He is also the national convener of the Australian Greens for 2009. Possibly not well known is that he also holds a PhD from Monash University. So I heard today that Kylie Minogue was offered a PhD, an honorary doctorate, but I can tell you that that Adam earned his with hard sweat and tears studying the erosion of rights by governments of various persuasions. So he is going to talk to us for about 10 minutes about a political perspective, followed by Peter, who I'll introduce when the time is appropriate, who will give us the technical perspective, and then for a perspective about society, we'll have Michael Porter at the end, followed by discussion and questions. So if I could invite Adam to come and address us.
Thanks very much for that introduction. I'm the member for Melbourne, which this electorate is in, and I think it's no coincidence that this electorate is with so many students in it, with such a high concentration of science and research facilities, such a high concentration of educational institutions, is the first one at a federal general election to go green. We're coming up to a year now in this minority parliament. If you were to believe everything that you read in the Herald Sun and everything that Tony Abbott says, you would think this government is on the verge of falling down, nothing's getting done. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. There's a great deal of effort that goes into creating this sense that everything is unstable, but we've, in this Parliament, already in a year passed, I think it's 191 pieces of legislation, which compares in 1 year, which is more than the Howard government passed in their first 2.5 years. And we're in an environment where, because no one party in Parliament has a majority on in either the House or the Senate, it actually requires politicians to do something they might not be used to doing, and that is to talk collaboratively with other politicians from different parties in order to get legislation through. And in fact, it's working, as I've indicated, and we're in a situation now where something that I'm incredibly thrilled about, we are in the midst now of being about to pass our climate package for the first time. Australia is going to be taking a comprehensive response to the climate change challenge, which I think is absolutely critical and a great contribution that I think Melbourne has made to national political history in Australia, because it was one of the first things that we put on the table when we sat down with the government in the days after the election. It's an interesting thing to do, I can assure you, to wake up on Sunday morning and walk down to North Melbourne for a coffee and listen to your voicemail and find you got a message from both Julie Gillard and Tony Abbott. It's not something that will happen very often in my life, I'm sure. I want to perhaps say some things that are probably truisms for many of you attending here, but I think it's important to remind ourselves why it is that we're talking about such an important topic. I mean, water is fundamental to life, to all life, and virtually every living thing on this planet owes its existence in some way to water. But it also, and we often forget this, but it underpins our economy and our society. And by any measure, it's an important and a precious resource. Yet, if you're an outsider looking in at Australia and the way that we live, you would think that the way that we organise our society is as if water was unlimited and infinite. But it's increasingly clear that that's no longer sustainable. Even without the impact of climate change, as the world's driest continent, we would have a challenge. But the impacts of climate change are going to make the need to address water, both in our cities and across the country, all the more pressing. And despite the existing water restrictions, Australians are amongst the highest consumers of water per capita in the world, around about 100,000 litres of fresh water per year. And despite the recent change in the weather, most Australian cities are still facing a water crisis. And we need to start, for climate change reasons as well as others, we need to start planning for less rain now. And for too long, we've relied on building more dams and pipelines to increase our water supplies. But I don't think we can continue to rely on that approach. Australian cities must turn around growing demand and put in place efficiency standards and incentives so that urban growth does not continue to demand a larger proportion of our limited water supplies. And I think we need nothing less than a change in the way that we think about our water resources. From our perspective, the Greens, we believe that we should be investing in water conservation, in demand reduction, water efficiency, stormwater harvesting, and less rainfall-dependent infrastructure, such as water recycling, rather than more dams and energy-hungry infrastructure. And I'll outline the specifics of some of our approach, which may end up being significantly challenged by the presentation that you're about to hear. But let's just reflect on the current situation. We have a current state government, or previous state government, that instead of investing for the long term in recycling and harvesting, opted for an expensive desal plant. And the current state government not only has continued that on, but straight away scrapped the Target 155 campaign, 155 campaign. And at the federal level, we have, I think, unfortunately, a government that is currently lacking the courage to make the big decisions and take on vested interests in water, as we saw, I think, with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan fiasco. And just as an aside, that's an amazing illustration of the power of vested interests in lobbying. We saw an initial draft report that said, look, at a minimum, you'd be needing somewhere around 3,600 gigalitres to flow as a basic bare minimum. But if you really wanted to ensure that at the end of the system, end of the Murray-Darling system, if you wanted to ensure with at least 80% likelihood that the lower lakes in the Coorong and so on were going to remain viable, you would need somewhere around about 7,600 gigalitres. That 7,600 gigalitre figure was forgotten within about a week, and the whole debate became about saying 3,000 to 4,000 gigalitres is too much, and the government's now gone back to the drawing board and putting that as the upper limit. And I think it's going to be much to our national detriment over many, many years that we haven't seen a more courageous approach to tackling Murray-Darling Basin. The 2010 budget also saw $1 billion cut from environment programs, including cuts to urban water conservation programs, and a $179 million cut from rainwater tank and grey water recycling. And sadly, the most recent budget saw the National Rainwater and Grey Water Initiative terminated. We also saw significant cuts to the National Urban Water and Desalination Plan. But South Australia, nonetheless, continued to receive the bulk of funds for their desal plant. I can say that because of the lobbying of many groups led by the NGO WaterAid, we were able to help get Kevin Rudd's department to maintain a commitment to water projects in the aid program, which I think is critical. But here in Australia, it seems that since the Toowoomba referendum fiasco and the rise of developer-orientated desal projects, the appetite for water recycling has continued to decline amongst state and federal governments. Our plan, which we took to the last election, was based around reducing demand for water through the introduction of minimum water efficiency building standards and bolstering supply by promoting greater use of stormwater. And I'm currently working on a project discussing with the federal government a project to see if we can get exploring sewer minings around docklands and trying to get some significant funding in for that. But to outline basically our policy, we wanted to see national mandatory water efficiency standards for all new residential and industrial commercial developments. And that should include a requirement for basic minimum water sensitive design features. We went to the last election proposing the idea that we should have a second pipe network to supply non-potable water to all buildings in the development for use in toilets, laundry, and for non-potable industrial applications. I'm really looking forward to hearing why that's an expensive and bad idea. There's not many people who have challenged us by saying you don't need to do it. Everyone has told us, well, don't worry about doing it because I'm sure we can find other ways of doing it, whereas in fact that's just developers saying we don't want to have to spend the money to meet basic environmental efficiency standards. I'm really looking forward to hearing whether there is in fact a better way to do it. We should also make it compulsory for systems for rainwater capture and reuse, as well as industry-specific water efficiency features. We'd like to see developer tariffs customised to give incentives for more involved water-sensitive design, such as stormwater capture, water recycling and smart sewers. Just on this, developers currently pay significant tariffs to local authorities to hook up essential services, such as water, to new developments. Huge water savings are available if these tariffs are structured to provide incentives for water-sensitive design. The Prime Minister's Science, Engineering and Innovation Council reported in 2007 that savings potentially obtainable as a result of decisions by developers and builders may be as high as 80% of total available savings. The Pimpama-Coomera development on the Gold Coast is a good example of what can be achieved through developer tariffs. It used a second pipe network, water recycling, rainwater tanks, smart sewers and stormwater management to yield a 65% decrease in potable water consumption and an 85% decrease in wastewater released to the environment at an increased cost of only 6%. Turning now to the National Urban Water and Desalination Plan, just a few comments to set the scene before we move into the speech. I think the plan should be adapted to better accommodate stormwater harvesting projects. The minimum capital expenditure for an eligible project under the plan is $30 million, of which the government will contribute 10%. Yet stormwater infrastructure is often handled by local councils who do not have these sorts of funds. Lowering the minimum spend to, say, $500,000 would enable a greater diversity of smaller projects to secure funding, and may well address the lower than expected demand that the government has used to justify cuts to the program. However, there is value in encouraging local councils to work cooperatively to implement more integrated projects over larger areas. So councils seeking to implement smaller projects should be required to demonstrate that they've explored more ambitious cooperative options in concert with neighbouring councils, water corporations or other relevant parties. The criteria for funding under the plan could also be tweaked to take account of the full range of benefits of stormwater harvesting projects that create dispersed urban lakes and wetlands to store the captured water. And I think this has a number of co-benefits as well. It would help us create some pretty attractive green spaces in our cities. It'll help counteract the urban heat island effect and contribute to the health of urban waterways. But without criteria that capture these benefits, I think the plan is predisposed to approve cheaper stormwater projects that store the captured water underground in aquifers. The upshot of this is that the other potential benefits of stormwater harvesting are foregone, and most of the projects that are funded are confined to locations where suitable aquifer storage has been identified, such as Adelaide. Now, one of the things I think would make a significant difference to this debate and to advancing the cause of water recycling generally is if the government funded a full-scale water recycling plant as part of a community education program on the science and safety of recycling. I think that until such a project is operating somewhere in Australia, it will be much harder to gain community acceptance for where we need to get to, which is full recycling into the water supply. Now, sometimes, and to conclude, as the recent floods show, sometimes we can have, or we can think we can have, too much water. Last year I met with officials from Melbourne Water to discuss the work they were doing to map and mitigate the problem of flooding in the electorate of Melbourne. I think this is going to become a problem that will be exacerbated in some areas because of sea level rise in the decades to come. I heard today that it'll be as little as 50 centimetre sea rise before our toilets stop flushing automatically in Melbourne because of the sewage system that we've got and the sea level and the level above sea level that we're at. But I believe that water harvesting can assist with mitigating some of the effects of flooding. Getting water right is crucial to our future prosperity and ultimately our survival as a society. We cannot continue to treat water like a bottomless well. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to open up the speech this evening. And I want to commend the work that you're doing here at the university, and I really look forward to hearing tonight why we might be wrong. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Adam. I'm sure that we all agree that good policy is informed by the best available science. And this evening we're going to hear from an expert on water, Peter Scales. He's a professor in chemical and biomedical engineering at this university, and he has a long-term interest in separations technologies and colloidal particle processing, that is, getting the solids and the liquids separated. Obviously, one application of this work is in water purification, not only for drinkable water, but also in the mining industries. And he also has put his considerable talents to considering things like biofuels from algae and tailings disposal and remediation of clay-rich streams in the mining industry. He's also, in his spare time, Deputy Dean of the School of Engineering, a Fellow of Engineers Australia and the Institute of Chemical Engineers, and he sits on the editorial board of a number of journals. He's also published over 175 papers as an inventor of 6 patents and, most impressively, runs every week with the university group. And if you look at his fit and smiling face, you'll see that he combines the very best of an active mind and body. And with that, Peter, I invite you to come and speak to us about water recycling.
Well, thanks, Stephen, and thanks everyone for coming along. I suppose it's an interesting introduction from a politician to be asked to tell him why he's wrong. And so, of course, I wouldn't do that. This is a topic that is dear to my heart, so to speak, in that we live in a nation that is nominally short of water, but as a nation, we, as Adam has said, flush most of the water that we use every day out to sea. We use it only once on average. And if we look around the world, that doesn't happen very much. There's a certain amount of non-logical behaviour usually starts to happen if I say to someone, well, why don't we re-drink wastewater? So I teach fourth year engineering, and I say to them, well, you're engineers, using the technology you've got, we can produce some of the purest water in the world. So therefore, I'm going to give you a job, which is to go and wee in the bucket over there, and we, in 2 hours' time, are going to produce very pure water, and you're going to drink it. And given that you know that it'll be pure water, how many of you will do it? And the logic usually comes back that about 30% of them say, yeah, that's fine, and the other 70% say, I know it's pure, but I'm not going to do it. So although I'm going to talk about the technical aspects of recycling water, there's obviously a lot more than technical things to be dealt with in this topic. And I look forward, therefore, after me, to Michael Porter telling us how we might get around some of those non-technical issues. However, I'd like to run you through a sort of an overview of how I see what we should do in this space. I'm not saying that we'll achieve it in the next 5, 10, 15 years, but I'm saying this is technically what I believe we should do. What we will do may be quite different, but let's go anyway. So, as an overview, I want to talk through why I think there might be a sort of an illogical response in this area, and that is the whole what I call water sanitation and health area, and the historical versus a modern day version of that, why we might want to recycle. I want to talk about water sensitive cities and sources of water, and look at that water balance across, just as an example, Melbourne, to try to brighten you to what Melbourne could look like if we truly were a recycling city. I will run through some of the technology on producing potable water to try to convince you that it actually is available and it works. You don't have to be convinced. I'm just going to, you know, run through it with you. I'll give a couple of snippets because I know there's a couple of people in the audience here that are a lot more adept at me in this whole area, and that sort of worries me in a public lecture, in the sense that we have people that might have a passing interest right through to people who are extremely adept in this area. And then something about the human need for new technology deployment. So, a couple of acronyms before I start, just so that when I use the words again, you'll actually know what I'm talking about. Wastewater, we all know what that is. We'll call that water discharge to the sewer. Potable water, water suitable for drinking. We're not specifying what quality that is, by the way. It's just suitable for drinking. And there's no actual definition of that, interestingly enough. Recycled water, which is recycled from, could be from wastewater, from stormwater or groundwater, and it could be any of class C, B, A or potable. What's the difference? Basically, this is not, class C is not guaranteed to be free of microbes, through to class A that is guaranteed to be free of microbes, through to potable, which we would hope we could drink because it didn't have a whole range of other things in it as well. Direct potable reuse, which I'll use DPR, which is basically taking purified wastewater and putting it directly back into the water supply for drinking, straight out of your tap. That's the one that worries a lot of people. Indirect potable reuse, which is what we call planned reuse, where we purify the water and then we mix it back into a water course, a natural water course, and then we pull it back out of that again and reuse it. And there's quite a lot of that happens around the world. And then there's unplanned indirect potable reuse or inadvertent reuse, which is a nice way of saying you happen to drink recycled water, but you didn't really realise it. And in actual fact, I would say that anyone who's sitting here that has lived out of Melbourne at all probably has been involved in this. And they wouldn't know it if you've drunk any water out of the Murray River, if you've drunk any water overseas in any of the major cities overseas. You've had this inflicted on you. And one of the things that I want to work through today in this evening's talk is to talk about the concept of why would we do this if we could do one of these two, where one is very well regulated and guaranteed quality and the other one is not. But I'll get back to that later. So why do we have a bit of an illogical response to drinking recycled water? Well, it's only 100 years ago that we sewered cities like Melbourne and some of the big cities in the world. Until then, one of the major things that we did or thought about was the most important thing in terms of public health was to remove the pathogens from the people. You take the pathogens that you produce in your toilet and wherever you do, and you remove them from the people. And the way to do that was you have your water supply on one end of the city, you have your city here, and you have your sewage treatment plant as far away as possible, and you discharge it into the sea, and that got rid of it. It got rid of the pathogens. And that was a pretty useful thing to do. In actual fact, in the 1890s, or late 1885, Melbourne was, from a public health point of view, a pretty awful city. And one of the first graduates in engineering of this university was a guy called William Thwaites, who was actually a person who was asked to speak at the age of 26 on the Royal Commission into Melbourne's sanitary conditions, which wouldn't have been a very hard thing to speak about, I'd imagine, because it was a pretty smelly city. In 1889, in 1891, they made him the engineer-in-chief of the newly formed MMBW, and from 1892 to 1897, he was in charge of installing what we now know is our sewer system in Melbourne. So it's about 110 or 120 years old. And a little bit like the NBN, in about 1897, they had their first house connection, so it takes a while to get everyone connected to the sewer if you're going to sewer the whole city. And this picture was apparently taken in about 1901, and from what I can gather, he was about 47 or 48 years old, and I don't know, I don't think he travelled all that well, but he died not long after that, surprisingly enough, so either he didn't travel well or he'd had a really good life, he'd done it hard and done it well. But in 1907, according to a recent book that's about to come out, there was 110,000 people went to his funeral as his body was carried on a gun carriage down Swanston Street, and they clanged their bedpans in appreciation of this man. Probably one of our greatest engineers in this city, and most people wouldn't know his name. But what he did was change dramatically the public health of Melbourne. And that is one of the reasons why we have traditional sewer systems that we have today, is that we do need to separate pathogens from the people. And indeed, if you look around the world, and this is a map taken off the World Health Authority website, if you look at places around the world that don't even have those basic facilities currently, probably around about 40% of the world's population does not have that as a basic. So if we went back to 1889, 40% of the world today does not have that basic sanitation. In actual fact, greater than 2 billion people have parasitic worm infections, which sort of doesn't, it sort of pulls the cheeks in a bit, doesn't it? And And in terms of this data here, these dark colours say that between 500 and 1,000 people per million people in those countries die of waterborne disease. And most of them are all the things that you'd think were highly preventable, like dysentery, cholera. They don't die of typhus, which is a hygiene-related thing, but it certainly weakens them to the point where they can die of other things pretty easily. And similarly, schistosomiasis, which is also doesn't kill them, also trachoma doesn't kill them, but they're all water health and sanitation-related issues around the fact that you haven't separated the people from the pathogens. So given that we've got a system that does that very well, why would we change it? And the argument I'll make is that we have the technology to change it now and to do something very different. And why would we use wastewater as our source of water? A lot of people don't realise we bring about 1,000 megalitres of water into this city every day, and about 900 megalitres go to wastewater treatment plants. So if you could recycle that water, it is actually our most secure source or most reliable source of water in terms of recycled water. Things like stormwater is also potentially a good source of recycled water and a whole range of other sources, but they're quite intermittent. This is actually a source of water that is there every day of the week and it never varies. If I use it 5 hours or 6 hours later, it turns up at the water treatment plant. So if I was to recycle that, I could significantly change the water balance in a city. If I was to look at it relative to the cost effectiveness of something like desalination, for people who don't realise, other than the capital cost, costs probably around about 2 to 3 kilowatt hours of electricity per metre cubed. What's that? If it's 15 cents per kilowatt hour, it's around 30 to 45 cents of electricity per 1,000 litres of water. If I was to actually desalinate wastewater, it's down at around about 0.6, so operationally a lot cheaper. I'll talk about the kind of technology that means that we can hopefully manage that process. There's also a lot of environmental benefits. One of the big things that we probably don't realise is that we have nitrogen and phosphorus shortages in our agricultural areas. We spend a lot of time growing things, nitrogen and phosphorus, we bring them to the city, we put them into ourselves, we transport that to the wastewater treatment plant, and the phosphorus and the nitrogen get sent to the sea. We then go and buy expensive fertilisers and try to put it up, start the process all again. There's actually a phosphorus shortage in the world, and if you actually stop putting nitrogen and phosphorus into the sea and into the bay and other watercourses, there's tremendous benefits. In actual fact, Melbourne Water almost has a bounty on how much they are prepared to pay to decrease the input into their river systems, etc., by 1 kilo of nitrogen. So if you put all that together, if we were able to recycle all that water, we could actually improve our water supply security tremendously, perhaps by up to a factor of 3. So if you thought we've got enough water for a city of 4 to 5 million people, we might actually have enough water for 15 to 20 million people in Melbourne. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to think of Melbourne as a city of 20 million people, Sao Paulo or something like that, but could we actually produce a city with enough supply that was sustainable? To do that, we assume that we can remove the viruses and the protozoa and the nematodes and the bacteria and the salt and the metal and the organic contaminants that we all worry about in that water. A lot of people say to me, but we don't need to put this back into potable. We've got third pipe systems, we've got water tanks, we can put them back into the toilet, we've got a desalination plant we've just built, so it'll do us for quite a long time, a whole range of things. And so, isn't this enough? And certainly, on a lot of new developments now, nearly all of them from a development point of view, not all of them, but quite a few of them, and as Adam has said, have what we call a third pipe system. Some people call it second pipe, some people call it third pipe. What it means is that I'm taking recycled water and I'm putting it back into basically the toilet in my system, or maybe into washing as well. And these new developments, there's a 12,000 house one in Sydney, there's one in Mawson Lakes near Adelaide, which is a twin pipe system. There's an interesting scenario in this one. I always love telling it, and that is that for about a year, there was a house that was plumbed backwards in that in that estate. And they didn't get sick, surprisingly enough. In actual fact, the water quality was probably better than a lot of countries around the world. It's just that people always worry about that. Have you plumbed me up the right way? So what's the way I think about this area? And one of the pieces of graphics that I used was developed by Rob Skinner, who was the former CEO of Melbourne Water. And it's the concept of what we call a city of the future, or water-sensitive city. And it starts with the concept that if we start most cities as a few people and then they need a water supply, and then they realise they need to sewer the city, then they realise that they've got a flood problem, so they drain the city, and then they've got pollution, so they get rid of the point sources. And then if we were to become a water-sensitive city, we would recognise that all water is actually useful water, and we might start to recycle water in the city. And if we truly want what we call a water-sensitive or very sustainable city in terms of water, then every bit of water in the city we're going to have to reuse. Simple as that. And if we did that in Melbourne, there's enough stormwater and there's enough wastewater to almost get away with the dam system. You wouldn't get away with it completely, but you could actually have a city that existed in that context. But there's an elephant in the room, as the saying goes, and the elephant in the room is that if I look at how we use water both domestically and in our industry, we use about 60% of our water domestically in Melbourne and about 40% industrially, and that's pretty standard across Australia for big cities actually, and a lot of them around the world. And if we look at how we use that water, if we actually produced a water-sensitive house, which is we put into it lots of water-saving fittings and everything like that, and we looked at how much water we could use as recycled water in that house and how much we would need as potable, and this is some data for an estate in Sydney where they actually, poor people, for a whole year, they actually, you know, recorded every bit of water they used and wrote it all down. And they used about 43% in the shower. I always say I've got a younger son who's here tonight who uses more than that. Hand basin, all these things. And if you go around here and you say how much of this needs to be potable in a water-sensitive house in the future, the answer is that about 70% of our water that we use every day needs to be potable. And yet most of all the recycling schemes we've got basically say that we can recycle about 30% of our water very easily that way, but after that we're looking for a use for it. We're cleaning it up, we're making it better, but we're actually looking for a use for it that's not domestic. We're trying to on-sell it somewhere else. And currently Melbourne's at about 20% recycle. So in another 10%, we're going to be at the point where, in actual fact, we'll have lots of water to recycle, but they won't have anything to use it on. And they'll finish up probably using it for what we call very low uses, for quality water that could be used for higher uses. And that, I think, is quite problematic. So we actually do need to think about how we're going to get water back into the potable system, not just recycle where we're not going to drink it. So you ask yourself, who actually does recycle water, either as direct potable recycle, which means they put it directly back into the system, or indirect, which means we deliberately put it back into the system? And you look around the world, and the obvious one is the space station. And if you think about it, they don't carry a lot of water up there, everyone. They've got a thing called the NASA Martini, which is basically the recycled water that goes round and round and round and round. There's a place in Namibia that's been recycling directly since 1987 for quite a large city. At the end of 2011, for those that go to Bali, you probably never drank the water out of the tap in Bali anyway, but if you do from 2011 onwards, it will actually be direct potable recycled water and a lot higher quality than it has been in the past, I will try to show you. And Singapore is going through a slow evolution, I won't call it a revolution, and they've actually recycling a very large amount of their water every day. They're actually putting some of it back into their reservoirs, about 2-3%. They're putting most of it to industry, but they're also bottling the water directly out of the process, and they give it to every school kid in Singapore. And if you go to the facility, it's a great facility, and the first thing they offer you as you walk through the door is a bottle of water. And sure enough, after a while, you tend to take the tap off and you have a drink, and guess what? It's pretty good stuff. And their argument is simply one of a generational one that says that in 10 or 15 years' time, everyone in Singapore will have drunk recycled water. So if they then say, I'm going to put it back into the system, people will probably say, oh, well, so be it. But at the moment, surprisingly enough, they're sending higher quality water than they need for drinking to industry. We have a project in Australia called the Western Corridor Project that was developed as an indirect potable recycle, and Adam can probably comment as to why 17 days before the election, when the reservoir filled up, they decided to pull out of putting it into the water supply. That's a political thing, not a scientific thing. However, it still produces about 200 and something megalitres of water a day, equivalent to a quarter of Melbourne's water supply, and it produces drinking quality water, and it puts it not back into Winehoven Dam, which you may have heard of in the floods last year, filled up, and it sends it past Winehoven Dam to a power station for use in boilers, etc. However, we do have a fully operational facility in Australia that's in Brisbane that could supply most of Brisbane's water as indirect potable recycle. And Yokohama in Japan, most of their water is in this. Around the world, huge number of cities do unplanned stuff. That is, I call it the magic river. You take the water out of the wastewater treatment plant, you throw it in the river, it goes a kilometre or two down the river, you pull it back out again, and something magic happened in the river. What happened? Very little. So, we can actually produce very high quality water through this process. Most cities in the world elect not to. They are unregulated. And one of the worries that I have in this space is that I talked about removing the pathogens from the people as an argument for a big city like Melbourne 100 years ago. There are other things in our water supply that you'd also now want to remove from the people. We have a lot of things that, from a pharmaceutical point of view and a cosmetic point of view, that finish up in our water supply that we wouldn't want to recycle. And people that do what I call unplanned water recycle actually don't regulate those very well necessarily at all, endocrine disruptors and a whole range of other things. So why would I prophesize that we should be starting to think about direct potable recycle? Well, the first of them is we take a river and a dam, we take water, we treat it, and a lot of people probably don't realize We have about 40 intermediate storages in Melbourne. So it goes to these storages as a place where it's then distributed out into households. It's distributed to households, we use it, it goes to the sewer, to a wastewater treatment plant, and then it gets discharged. So this unplanned stuff basically says that it inadvertently gets back into the river and it gets reused again. The next option is that we use some plant, it might be a membrane plant, to treat the water and produce third pipe, which is water that is class A or something like that, back into our houses. Or it could go back into a water source in indirect potable resource like I talked about for Brisbane. Or the other option is you literally put it straight back into the intermediate storage. Why would you do that? Well, I would say that the practice that happens around the world doesn't guarantee quality. That's been happening for a long time, and as we all start to take a lot more pharmaceuticals in our lives, guess where it all finishes up? It all finishes up in the river, everyone. Someone said to me recently, talk to any 50-year-old and ask them if they haven't taken a pharmaceutical in the last week. We could probably do a show of hands. Any 50-year-old up here hasn't taken a pharmaceutical in the last week. There's more 50-year-olds in the room. So, indirect potable recycle is a pretty good buffer against things like treatment failure. One of the things that people worry about in this process of recycling is, I've got this membrane plant, what if it fails? What happens if the membranes fail and the muck gets out? I know a lot of people talk to me tonight about the fact that I shouldn't have called this toilet tap, I should have called it toilet to teeth. But one of the problems with IPR is that, yes, we've got a lot of dam storage in a lot of cities, but we do have to actually put it into the dam, and then we contaminate the water we've produced, and we've got to treat it again. That's sort of silly, really. We actually go to a lot of trouble. We clean the water up to make it very clean. We put it back into a water storage, and then we've got to clean it up again. And we do it simply to give the public a better sort of warm, fuzzy feeling that it's a safer process, which it probably is in a lot of ways because we're putting it into a big buffered environment. Class A requires third pipe, and I'm not saying for new developments that's a bad thing. I'm saying that for a brownfields development, if I'm putting a new building up in the middle of Melbourne, that's not a particularly good option. And if we think about direct potable, we don't have to retreat the water again. It goes back into intermediate storage. We're not pumping it as far. A whole range of potential benefits there if we're prepared to do it. I'm not saying we will. I'm just saying this is my vision for where we should be in the future. So how do we clean it up? Some technical things. I'll quickly run through one of the main processes by which we clean up wastewater. So we've got to take a few things out of wastewater. We've got to take microbes out, we've got to take salt out, we've got to take hormones out, we've got to take all the things you don't want in there. But we're pretty lucky, really, because water happens to be the smallest liquid molecule that we know. So if we set up a membrane with extremely small holes in it that are just big enough for water, we can separate it from nearly any other molecule in water. That's pretty useful. As an example, for seawater reverse osmosis, we take in 100 metres cubed of water, we put it through a thing called a reverse osmosis module, which I'll talk about shortly. At high pressure, we produce, for 100 metres cubed coming in, we produce 50 metres cubed of salt, and we produce 50 metres cubed of very clean water. That's what happens down at, is going to happen down at Wonthaggi and other places. The background here is that, for those that don't know about reverse osmosis is a process by which if I take pure water and I take a membrane that salt can't get through and I put seawater or some salty water here, and you say, which way will the water flow? The water will be drawn from the pure water into the salt water to reduce the concentration. Therefore, if I want this process to go the other way, I've got to apply pressure. So we pump the system. And if I apply pressure here, then I force the liquid out of here. I leave salt here and I concentrate the salt up and I produce more pure water on this side. That's a process called reverse osmosis. It's just a very fine filtration process. To have a look at the reverse osmosis process, we use a membrane, and the membrane is a very fine membrane. Here's a picture of one here. There's a backing. This is about 100 microns, this scale bar, so that's about 0.1 of a millimetre. So this whole thing is just over a quarter of a millimetre deep. We have something to give it some strength. We have a support layer, and right on the very top, a very, very, very fine layer with extremely small holes in it that is our way of separating the salt from the water. And that's usually what we call a polyamide system. And that's put in between different layers. We bring feed water in, we take a highly concentrated salt out, and we take a pure water out. So the salt builds up on one side and the pure water goes through. And it's wound into a module. And the pore size, for those that are interested, is usually about 0.6 nanometers, or 6 angstroms, and a water molecule is around about 3 angstroms in size. So it's a physical barrier, and it's not just a physical barrier, but it rejects most things on the basis of size. So if I think of most of the molecules that I'm worried about in my water supply, they don't get through this process. So it's only if it breaks that I've really got a problem. Here's some pictures of it installed in the Western Corridor plant in Brisbane. And they're the same modules that are used in the desalination plant down at Wonthaggi. Exactly the same process, except that one's doing seawater and the other one's doing wastewater. However, the wastewater plant, according to our health authorities, needs a few more what we call risk mitigation components put into it. And technically, we start with source control, which says that we stop people putting heavy metals into our supply. We have wastewater treatment, which is... We then do ultrafiltration, which gets rid of bacteria and viruses. We then do this reverse osmosis. Anything that gets through this, we hit it with UV and peroxide, which is to oxidise the crap out of it, is my sort of technical term. And then if it's indirect potable recycle, we blend it back into the reservoir, and then we have to put it through water treatment because it's blended with dirty water and we have to clean it up again. That's the bottom line there. So how clean is it? Well, bottled water, we all love bottled water. They even left three of them out here for us tonight. I thought that was interesting. I hate bottled water. It's really against all my principles, but I'll probably drink it because I'm getting dry. So what's in bottled water? Well, most bottled water, I have two types of water. I call them low-level water or gourmet waters. And I call them gourmet, and the Perriers and the Evians, because they're over $3 a bottle. To me, that's gourmet. They draw from the same sources as a lot of cities. You pay around 50 cents a kilolitre, in the city for this water, and you're paying about $3 a litre. So a factor of about 2,000 different out of the bottle on average. 25% of waters in the world don't document their sources. Why? Because they get it straight out of the tap. And they fill up the bottles and they've found out that's a pretty good way of making money. But you can get really pure water. From a chemical point of view, I know there's a guy here that does what we call force balance work, and you need really, really, really pure water. What's the purest water I've ever found in the world? We used to spend months making in the laboratory as a surface chemist. And then a guy told me once, I found the purest water in the world. You can buy it at Coles, and it costs about $6. It's called Nobel's Puro. It's a double reverse osmosis, double carbon process. And as far as we know, chemically, I cannot detect any contaminants in that water. It's the purest water I can find in the world. So if you want really, really pure water, I don't know what you'd want it for. $5 at Coles. I don't work for them. I'm just telling you. So if I'm not going to compare that water because it's not worth comparing it because I can't find anything in it. Okay? But if I was going to look at water quality, if I compared Perrier with Melbourne tap water with water coming off the Western Corridor plant, which is a recycled plant up in Brisbane, and I said, okay, I'm going to use the best chemical analysis I can find, and using that, you tell me which one you would drink. I'm not saying why, I'm just saying based upon the chemical analysis, which one would you drink? So here's some, for those that are not chemists, turbidity is basically how many little particles are in there. And this one's pretty low, and this one's a bit higher, and this one's pretty good. Colour is a bit of an indication of how many organic molecules are left in there. This one's really good. This one's got a bit of colour in it. This one's not bad. Conductivity is an indication of how much salt's left in it. This one's pretty low in the middle. This one's pretty terrible. pH won't ruin you. Dissolved solids, this one's quite high. This one's pretty good. Organic carbon, which is, this one's really low. This one's in the middle. This one doesn't tell me. Volatile organic carbon, synthetic organic carbon, not detected, not detected, not detected. So which one's which? Which one's Perrier? Which one's Melbourne tap water? And which one is recycled water? This is out of annual reports, by the way. Must be true. So this is recycled water from the Western Corridor project in Brisbane. They bottle it and feed it to school kids out of the plant. They're pretty confident it's okay. This is Melbourne tap water. This is Perrier. Okay? Next time you drink a lot of Perrier, just remember this number. And remember, it's actually not all that good for you. I'm not saying it's bad for you. I'm just saying don't use it as your only source of water. If you're going to do it, you might need some Nobel's Puro to go with it. So that's just a bit of a run into quality. And you can hopefully see that if I actually install a plant that has technically set up to do all that stuff, it works pretty well. So what would we need to do, and what are some of the research questions we work on? I'm just going to run for a couple of minutes through some research questions before I finish. Some of the research questions that we get asked to think about are, can we have an online quality guarantee for water? In other words, if I had an app on my phone that said, okay, I'm drinking recycled water, but I can go click and it tells me right now that I guarantee you that this water is good because of this thing, then people might be happier about that. Don't know. There's a lot of problems with what we call membrane fouling and operations within some of these plants. It doesn't affect the quality of the water, but it affects the cost because you're doing a lot more maintenance in these processes. So we work quite a lot on membrane fouling, and that's one of my research areas. How do we reduce energy costs? One of the first sort of thoughts on where we would start to install this sort of technology in Australia is to choose some poor bunny that's got no choice. So you go to a really remote site. So we're actually thinking of the most remote site in Australia, which is Antarctica. If you're actually running something in Antarctica, can we monitor and run the operations remotely? Can we actually put all the expertise in from here if they don't have it there to make sure and guarantee quality? And it's possible in these plants. And how do we actually reduce the cost over time by improving how quickly we can get water through these membranes, etc.? And so, just quickly, one of the things that in the future I see, and certainly the Japanese have been doing this for about 12 years, they use ceramic membranes up the front of their process, and the reason is that in 12 years they've never had a failure. And that means that they can actually guarantee to the public that certainly this area of what happens if I got a membrane failure and I was putting it directly back into the system, would that cause problems? Well, using ceramic systems, they've found that not to be the case. And there's still a lot of issues on fouling in these systems, but that's one of the areas that we're looking at. So we might not look at the process that, say, Western Corridor does into the future. We might actually put some ceramics and things up the front. The other reason we might use ceramics is that they're a bit more robust to cleaning processes and other things. We know that our teacups are a little bit better than our Glad Wrap in terms of cleaning processes. And you can think of this RO membrane as like Glad Wrap on top of a barrier. I told Feng, my PhD student, I'd put this up, but it's probably not a good idea. All I was going to explain out of it is that we've done a lot of research on why membranes fail with organic molecules. And this graph over here is the drag on the water molecule going through the fouling layer for materials that are particulate versus materials that are organic. And this is about 4 or 5 orders of magnitude different. And it tells us why we need, if we think about these processes and running them robustly, we can't afford to let them foul with biomolecules, because it will actually just stop the process dead and will go through a lot of cleaning cycles and cause a lot of maintenance problems. So one of the things that this teaches us is we've probably got to degrade this material before it hits the membrane. And I'll talk about that shortly. And we've been working with some Japanese colleagues in nano stuff, and I always like using nano in talks because no one understands it. And one of the things we're trying to do is produce a layer that's about 30 nanometers or less thick that still is robust, that has a very, very high permeability. And some Japanese colleagues have managed to produce that. Ichinose, everyone calls him Ichinose. And we're actually looking at how we put another layer on the top of this to stop fouling as well, so we can have high permeability, low fouling membranes embedded on a ceramic substrate that really gives us some very, very, very high permeabilities in these systems and hopefully good robustness in terms of cleaning. And this is our sort of scheme that we're now working on for how we would run a direct potable recycle plant with oxidation to kill off these organics that foul, ceramic filtration, reverse osmosis, and then we'd put some carbon in to take away any smell that was left. And that's what you can go and buy with a Brita filter if you like as well. So to finish, where to from here? Michael Porter will probably tell us that we're not going to go anywhere because we haven't got anything embedded in our society that tells us that we can actually just implant this very quickly. But I would argue that DPR or IPR can change the infrastructure and the water security and sustainability of a city. And if we don't put stuff back into the potable supply, not just the non-potable supply, we don't really change things a lot. We're actually with only 10 to 15% away from the limit of that capacity right now in terms of our total city. We can do it because membrane systems are robust. They've proven themselves to be robust over a large number of years. They produce very high quality water, better than what we've got in Melbourne at the moment. And it might actually be one of the great options for the developing world. One of the things I'm interested in is the fact that if you're building a new city, would you build it the same way as we build it now? You'd certainly build it very differently if you had this technology available to you. We can do it a lot more cheaply than desalination. And how do we get there? Lots of ways. Perhaps we need another good drought to get people convinced. Perhaps we need generational manipulation, which is what they're doing in Singapore, I would argue. They just slowly feed the population recycled water, and generationally, everyone gets used to it. So I'm going to finish, not with me, but with the last word from some friends of mine. And I apologise in advance for this, but I like this video for no other reason than I like the chasers.
Recycled water, as you know, Drew, we're in the middle of a drought, and pretty soon we'll have no water left unless we start recycling sewage or desalinating seawater.
Yeah, Craig, some of the country's best minds have been trying to solve this. People like Peter Debnam and Peter Beattie have been out there doing water taste tests with the public, but all to no avail.
So we thought we'd set up a taste test of our own this week, and we put our best man on the job.
Everyone's talking about recycled water and desalinated water now, but no one's actually trying it out. So we've got a taste test here for you. You don't mind?
No.
One of these is standard water, and one of these is recycled water.
The first one was better.
Like the first one better? A lot of people have a problem with the recycled water. I'm not actually sure why. The second one is the recycled water. I'm not actually sure why. What's the matter?
What is in this?
Oh, look, just a bit of discoloration, that's all.
No, what is it?
Let's do a direct comparison between standard water and desalinated water, okay? So we'll do some standard water here, and we'll do some desalinated water here, okay?
Why is it tipping?
It's full.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so. Can you tell which one's a desalinated water? Try again.
Something in it.
Just try and drink the water. Can you tell which one's desalinated?
Why is there a fish in there?
You get the odd impurity when you use seawater. Every now and then something gets thrown.
You can't taste the water.
You can't taste the water? There it is. A little bit more. There you go.
No.
You can't tell the difference? Pretty much the same. Okay.
No, because you know why? The smell is putting off the taste.
The taste is okay. It's just the smell of the fish that's the problem. Yeah. So you'd recommend if when we do desalinated water, we take the fish out?
Absolutely.
Thank you, everyone.
Peter, thanks very much. I think anyone who thinks that academics don't have a sense of humour doesn't know Peter, so we thank Peter again for an entertaining and wonderful lecture. So Michael Porter is now going to talk to us about the public policy implications. But Michael, I think that we've already got the solution. We just have to take the fish out of the water. Just before Michael comes up here, Michael is Professor of Public Policy at the Alfred Deakin Research Institute. He spent time at Yale University and was formerly with the IMF. So he's got a lot of international experience, and now he is co-director of the Australian Water Project, which is a joint water research and policy venture between UniWater Harvard University, Alfred Deakin Research Institute, and CEDA. And the object of that institute is to lift the national and international debate on water issues and to recommend an exemplary reform agenda for water policy and institutions, which I hope will include removing the fish from the water. Michael.
My middle name is Wanda. I'd like to congratulate the Institute for having this sort of gathering. I think if the electrical engineers had done this in the late 70s, early 80s, we would have got restructure of electricity much quicker. And I'd also like to make the point that, it's a very purist point that you don't really expect from an economist, that there's no such thing as unrecycled water. Nobody in this room, particularly if they have mathematical skills, can reject the proposition that there's a non-zero probability that that water passed through the mouth and orifice of Julius Caesar. There is nothing in the world other than recycled water. But that doesn't mean there's not very real issues, and I thought everything that's been said tonight I have no difficulty with, because there really are options for recycling sewage and for doing things. We know it works, we know the technologies, and there's... My point is, and I think the point is, the same as for water as it was for electricity. What we want is for the innovation and competition and taste tests and safety tests to be placed in a proper competitive process so that we don't get the sort of circus we're seeing with the NBN when one politician on a plane with another decides to impose a technology that costs us as taxpayers $50 billion. For a technology that may actually be easily beaten by a range of other competitive technologies that also have a national capacity to increase broadband speeds. In the case of water, if we think back to the electricity example, the savings we effected by enabling competition across generators, by separating distribution, by pricing and trading, wholesale and retail, back when my think tank at Monash first estimated these things, were of the order of $2 billion a year, although the Productivity Commission's predecessor found that number to be conservative. So one of the points I want to make is that I'm profoundly in favour of recycling water getting into the system, but that really depends on technologies that are becoming cheaper and cheaper and cheaper being implemented. It's been a great week for physics, but I meant that Brian Smith's wife was an economist at the Productivity Commission, and she fired him up to sort of expand the universe. And I'd also like to say it's a very sad day because Steve Jobs died today. And a lot of what I want to say has underneath it the understanding that whatever we could do regarding water markets last year is even better this year. But wasn't possible 20 years ago. We can build sensors. NICTA in this university gave me the privilege of looking at some of their work a while back. We can put sensors into rivers and drains and sewers and whatever and convert whatever's going on through that pipe or drain or river into a vector so that one laptop, can and does control 100,000 gates in the Goulburn River project. 100,000. So if it rains, the gates close. If you're growing one thing rather than another, you get different amounts of water. Similarly, you can do for sewage, and I saw this from the French back 15 years ago when I was working in a range of Asian countries with Lyonnaise de Zoe. You can now use sensors to tell us exactly what it is that's water. When I was a professor at Monash, was chairing a seminar, and the guy who gave the seminar started off with the assumption that he's running about water markets. And he said, well, first we make the assumption that water is a perfectly homogeneous good. And as the chairman, I interrupted him and said, that's the most furthest assumption from the truth you could possibly make. Pure shit through to H2O, nuclear contaminated water. Don't assume in your model that water is the most homogeneous. I regard water economics as the hardest field of all because you can treat water and measure it, but go through a pipe in Cebu that I looked at And because there's a gap, because pressure's so low, it sucks in the surrounding stuff, and pure water is going into the pipe and sewage is coming out because of vacuums and suction issues. So the whole nature of water is that somehow we have to find structures to get this great science that this institute and others are putting together and blend it with IT and sensing sciences, and then with economics coming in, as it always does, with the master stroke to discipline the atoms of the world, because we don't want tens of billions spent when single billions will do the trick. And we do want wastewater X competing with wastewater Y, competing with desal A, or whatever. We want the desal plant at Wonthaggi to be selling into a grid that is competitive. Now, it's very easy to stir up the community, as was done in Brisbane. Brisbane has built a water grid. Brisbane does have, you know, the various alternative water supplies, including recycled water. But the Vice Chancellor, I think, of Greenfield, was of Brisbane, he was in a humiliating position of having to see that whole thing turned off, and now it doesn't do what it's supposed to do because of ignorance in the community. So we need a lot of seminars like this. We need a lot of communications. I think if I go back to when we were stirring the pot on electricity, we had hundreds of seminars regarding how water electricity trading would work. I think water trading is a much harder topic, but I do congratulate the Institute and my colleagues, John Briscoe, who should be here talking, not me, or John Langford, who's in the United States this week. We all agree passionately that what we need is for the irrigation water savings that are being affected through better use of IT and technologies, and where you tune the release of water to the crop, where you have laser flat surfaces, where you really optimise on the release. The savings from the Goulburn project, forget about some of the silly costs, the savings are about equal to Melbourne consumption. So we are talking about somehow enabling an interaction between irrigation savings, irrigation uses, recycling water, desalinated water, which, of course, there's an infinite amount. There is an infinity of water. Now, Australia is actually the wettest country, not the driest, the wettest country per capita in the world, per capita. The issue with water is transportation, getting water to where it's needed. So I think we ought to realise that the aquifers of Asia are totally contaminated. The Bangkok's sinking, I've been all over China, you can't tell water from wastewater, etc., etc., as we heard before. So this is a very exciting time for Australia. We are actually, I predict confidently, and my colleagues Briscoe and Langford agree, in a situation where Australia is going to have a comparative advantage in water-intensive food. We will be a food bowl for Asia because their aquifers are stuffed and ours are not. We can pump from the cities, sorry, from the sea to the cities, and as a percentage of our income, it's still very, very low. We can recycle water, because what I want is a model in which, you know, the recycled water that we're discussing tonight competes in a grid, in a market, with the desal water. Because then we, the mugs who pay taxes, right, we then have a way of benchmarking. And look what happens when you just have a politician dictator technology. I won't go into the NBN again. When we look at the dictating, It's frightening. I mean, some politician in Brisbane made that decision on recycling. Imagine if that had evolved naturally in a competitive way with agreed standards for monitoring. So I just want to make those points that we are now in a situation where we know that the La Nina and El Nino phenomena and the climate change issues are making water a more important commodity. Now, what do you do when something is scarce? You price it, you trade it, you value it. That's what's missing from the equation. Price has not been mentioned tonight. I guess that's why I was invited along to mention it. But and I am mentioning it, and I'll mention it again and again and again. If it ain't priced, it's worth nothing. And if it's priced at zero, it's wasted. And that's part of the problem with water. I think we have an issue also that people must realise that basically the issues with water are transportation and energy. We want the best science, and we're getting very good science. As far as I was concerned, a few years ago when I looked at this and talked to some really good scientists, Israel seemed to be number one, Australia's number two. Briscoe at Harvard, who's now the head of their water project, was the head of the World Bank water program, which I did lots of stuff around Asia. He would say that Australia's now far ahead. But he looks at the MDB, the Murray-Darling Basin discussions, and tears his hair out. And his submission to the Murray-Darling Basin group is really worthwhile. You can get off the web, John Briscoe, Harvard. So I think we are in an exciting situation. Australia has led the world in bringing electricity and utilities trading to create efficiency. Australia has become better than England and the US in regulating financial markets. No great honour, though. We're the least worst in the world there. I also think we're the least worst in the world on water. And the scientists in water have models, have structures, have work that we see exemplified here today, which is state of the art. But it won't get anywhere and really help Joe Citizen of the world unless we also develop ways in which the different sources of water compete. So I probably should stop there, because I think that context is easy to say, hard to do, but we don't want the politicians picking a technology. I think Adam would agree, we need public discussion galore before those four poor guys are forced by the media and elections into saying yes or no to something that is actually capable of being resolved through a grid, through a market, and so forth. Thank you.
I'm now pleased to invite brief comments, but more desirably questions from the floor for any one of our speakers. If you could please state your name, and then we have a roving microphone. So questions, please. Yes, sir.
My name's Gordon. I wanted to know why we don't restructure our water bills to pay more directly for the actual water we use, thereby providing an incentive for people to actually use less water.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think perfectly sensible question. We should pay for what we use, and we should basically pay not necessarily a full cost, something potentially in excess of that, a bit like congestion charges. At the moment, we're not paying really the average cost. The desal plants in all five cities are all having their costs buried in the general system. If what I'm really suggesting is we create a reserve bank of water or something like that, NEMCO, the grid, the company that rules electricity, if we had a company charged under an act of parliament, Adam, with the rules of the game for efficient delivery of water and pricing and fair pricing of water, if that entity was then charged with buying and selling bulk water and facilitating that, and then having a retail set of businesses underneath that charged water to the household with insurance contracts in case the water was contaminated, if we move towards what will be in place in 100 years, a genuine market, wholesale and retail, with lots of bulk supplies, then I think we'll get there, but we've got to pay our way. At the moment, whether it's India or Australia or England, the most primitive country almost in the world on water, they have no metering at all in most of England. And then they advise the rest of the world on how to implement water reforms. If we move that way that you're suggesting, I think then we've got a chance. But if we don't start treating water as a scarce commodity, pricing it, trading it, comparing it in a grid, we'll never get there.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that That's not been the experience when we've done that with electricity. You just have to look at your electricity bills to see what happens. The cost gets passed on in some form or another. The costs associated with grid expansion still get passed on. It doesn't result in, I don't think, in costs going down. If we did have a rational system of pricing water and funding expansion, I don't think we'd have a desalination plant. I don't think the economics of it stack up, and yet nonetheless we do. And I think you find that you are, in fact, paying a user pays version of that on your electricity bill, on your water bill, rather, at the moment.
Just a footnote, that's been documented by independent regulators all over the world and by the Productivity Commission, that New South Wales, for example, is about 40% higher, despite cheaper coal, than the cost in Australia, in Victoria. So the evidence is in worldwide about the efficiency of getting competition into generation and distribution.
Maybe, are there any questions up the very back? Yes.
Hi, Robin McLeod. I was until recently the Water Commissioner in South Australia. So very committed, as you know, in South Australia to water recycling. About 50% of the water in South Australia is now being recycled, and stormwater is also being recycled. I am, however, Peter, I have very strong concerns about direct potable reuse of both sewerage and stormwater. There are a number of examples of where you can get fit for purpose uses for those kind of products. For example, you know, in Adelaide, as I said, 40% is going onto parks and gardens. A lot of the stormwater is being captured and going through third pipes into homes and industries. At the end of the day, for me, water is all about health, and it's about having the least number of interferences between the top of the hill and the dam and what comes out your tap at the other end. Now, I know we can polish water to be beautiful, and I will drink it any day of the week. I know how clean we can make it. But at the end of the day, you've got operator error, you've got interference factors. And so from my view, while we've got desal, while we've got recycling, while we've got pricing, while we've got demand management, I don't see why we need to directly. Indirectly is okay if it's economic. I don't see why we need to directly drink it.
Thanks for your opinion.
James Brown. I wanted to raise with Michael Porter an issue of pricing and competition and getting politicians out of choosing technologies. And the thing that I rather like, although it seems to have not got much support from various people, is the German approach that's been chosen for renewable energy, but it can be extended. And the basic principle is that the German government says to anyone who wants to put in a plant, what price can you deliver at? And they say, right, if you put in a plant in the next few years, then we will guarantee that feed-in tariff, water price, to be delivered to you for the next 20 years. Yeah. And that enables them to simply go out with a spreadsheet to a banker and raise money on a normal commercial basis. And no matter how, if you like, exotic the technology, you don't pay until it delivers. And you're using ordinary commercial fund management and risk management to fund these projects. I mean, if in the renewable energy area, you know, there are strong forces at the moment fighting, imagine when the money starts to flow, how much pressure there'll be put on politicians to choose this technology or that technology, whereas this divorces that process, and the price doesn't have to stay constant for 20 years. It's only for you who get that plant in. If the price goes down, if the technology improves, or if the technology doesn't, you wipe that and fund other things.
Yes, that, Jim, that's a version of what in the electricity industry is called order of dispatch.
Yes.
And you put the point more eloquently than I could have. And the banks, and I've worked inside investment banks and those horrible places, but the truth is if you can get a 20-year, 30-year, 40-year contract, as befits water investments, including recycling, if you can go there with an indexed contract, then you get the pension funds in with a lower cost of capital because of the certainty of the regulatory arrangement. So I think your point's an excellent one. That's really what I'm saying. We're just having ad hoc addition of projects, excellent or silly, are being decided politically. Water is too important to leave. I also make the point that it really is the case that Australia's economic future is going to be massively benefiting from export of food because we know how to use water properly, and this system you're talking about will work very well.
Yeah, but it's been discredited by being talked about as a feed-in tariff.
Yeah.
It's not, really. It's a much more comprehensive.
Yeah.
The other thing that's been demonstrated, that the cost of wind energy delivered in Germany is cheaper than any other place in the world because the risk has been taken out.
The cost of capital is done here.
I'm going to take Chairman's prerogative, Peter, and ask Peter a question. which is very naive, but Peter, in your diagram of directly having these local storages which take sewage and put fresh water back into the storage, what happens to the waste? In a desalination plant, you just ship the salty water out to sea. What happens to all of the...
The waste,
yes. Yeah.
Do you mind if I add in a question on that? That I was just whispering in his ear. I want to know why that process is cheaper than desalination.
Okay, I'll answer the second one first. The answer is the amount of salt. We're pushing against an osmosis or a pressure caused by the salt concentration. In the wastewater case, the concentration of salt is tremendously lower, therefore the pressure we have to apply and therefore the cost of it is tremendously lower. So that's the first one. The second one is on waste. Whole range of things you can do on waste. One of them is that locally you could put it into the sewer and say, well, I'm going to send it down to a single facility, or you could process it as a normal wastewater treatment plant does as waste. Now
you're talking about storages that are in the suburbs, right, and inside the city.
We have a problem in Australia in that we haven't ever really, in a lot of ways, dealt with what we call the sludges from our wastewater processes in a sophisticated way. I can give another talk on sludge if people want to wait an hour. And we tend to store it or use the old adage, the solution to pollution is dilution in Australia, and that is we dilute it out into the sea. However, we are, as a nation, probably going to have to do a lot more of what Europe does, and that is actually take that sludge and actually make it into a resource. There's a lot of nutrients in that sludge. There's also a lot of microbes in that sludge, and there's a lot of pathogens there. So how we deal with that, some people elect to burn it, some people elect to heat it up and destroy those pathogens and reuse it in a whole range of ways. But, yes, sorry, I didn't put the pipe that came out and where it goes. And in any of this process, as you start to rethink and rework these processes, you have to deal with the salts, you have to deal with the waste out of that process. At the moment, we tend to store them in big piles down at Carriman, Werribee and other places. A lot of places around Australia are finding beneficial reuse for those materials.
You've been waiting.
Lindrum, I've got an engineering question for you. Peter, just out of curiosity, what is the reliability of the technology? What is the main value for one of those RO modules? and how acceptable is it to say deliberate or malicious
sabotage
of the technology, if in place?
Everything's susceptible to malicious or deliberate sabotage. I'll say that. The question is, what is the consequence? A typical recycle plant is a large number of modules. And each of those modules has a monitor at the back end of it, usually in terms of conductivity or some indicator of when you have failure. So none of them are fail-proof, even though the ceramic technologies appear to be pretty close in that they've never had a failure. That's not to say that they're 100%. There's no such thing as 100%. So therefore, the average life of these units in the polymeric form is usually about 5 to 7 years, and there's a replacement across that period, usually because they're starting to get too permeable because of after they get washed, they a large number of times, they start to degrade slightly. So yes, you have to replace them. Yes, there's a monitor. What's the consequence of one of them failing? Not very much, in the sense that it's a failure of one unit in a very large number of units, and yes, it does contaminate the system, but it's a very, very small contamination into a very large water supply, one would argue, at any one module level. You can shut them down individually or whole modules down very, very easily. So in an engineering sense, either remotely or locally or automatically, there's monitoring systems that can shut these processes down, and around the world that operates pretty well. There are examples where it has failed and nothing's absolutely fail-proof, but it's getting pretty close.
I'd like to take just one more question. Is that Rick?
Peter, where's the heavy, where are the heavy metals coming from? And can you get rid of them so that you can reuse the phosphate, nitrogen, and so forth without spreading them back out on the paddock someplace?
The heavy metals are basically a source control problem. Some of it is industrial, and hopefully, I noted in source control, you can hopefully, from an EPA point of view, get rid of those at source. However, it's an unfortunate aspect of our society that we throw a large range of things down the toilet when we don't want it. I don't, but a lot of other people do. And so we do get a lot of cadmium and mercury and other things finishing up in that supply. They tend to be attached to the solids, which tend to be attached where we want our phosphates and nitrates. So until we get very good source control across our wastewater systems, we don't guarantee quality of our sludges for reuse. And that's certainly a problem in Melbourne. If you go historically out to somewhere like Werribee, there's huge mountains out there of sludge, but it's as a resource for fertiliser or something, not as usable as it could be because of past practices. However, what is coming through now with a lot better source control is a lot better.
I think we've been entertained tonight by three different views of the same problem, and we'd like, on behalf of the University of Melbourne and the Matures Institute, to present some non-recycled liquid. So, Adam, thank you very much. Peter. And thank you all. So, final thank you for our speakers who have, I'll note, by the way, that on the space station the recycling rate is 92%, that which includes recycling
the air that they breathe and the water that's in the air, and they need that, but they need it to be 98% to get to Mars. So it'll be interesting to see whether any of these technologies will get us to the 98% recycling. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for a little bit.